Descent of Women, a show by and about women from diverse cultures and languages right across the world. I'm Fiza, and today I will be sharing part two of a conversation I had with Dr. Sara Wijesinghe. Sara is a senior lecturer at Sunway University, Malaysia, with expertise in critical tourism, decolonization, and social equity. I met her when I was in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia last month and attended a Women's Day book event. During the panel, Sara spoke about her recent non-fiction memoir, The Illusions of Freedom, which critically examines neoliberal academia and its cultural norms, offering insights into how academic practices influence inclusivity in Asia. Her struggles with doing decolonial work within an inherently colonial institution resonated with me, and we decided to keep chatting about it. The conversation you're about to listen to was recorded in an open-air cafe in Kuala Lumpur in the midst of Ramadan, as we shared about our roots, our origins, our childhood memories, and traced our roots that led us to this journey of decolonization. You can hear the general cacophony of daily life in the background. Having now returned to the unceded indigenous lands here, listening to the sounds of my own homeland has been a soothing balm, and the beautiful tapestry Sarah and I weave together through this conversation reminds me of what bell hooks wrote in her book All About Love, that rarely, if ever, are any of us healed in isolation. Healing is an act of communion.
So there was this series that I watched on Netflix. It was the short stories of Rabindranath Tagore. And in one of the short stories, I really liked that part and stays in my mind to this day. This man is teaching his child and another child that came into his house English.
Okay.
But he says, before we start learning the language, I'm going to tell you the history about how this language came into our life.
Beautiful.
Wow. Because that's something that I never learned
exactly
when I learned English.
Yeah.
It was just this language that was imposed on us to learn. And it was what I learned is that you must learn this language. It's important if you want to succeed in life. You need this language. And also it became this like symbol that I need to achieve in order to be anything in life. How did it become important for me to learn this
language? Why did it become a lingua franca? Exactly.
So I really loved that scene, and I was like, I wish I had a teacher like this.
Right?
So
because having that before the English lesson shapes how you then receive the English lessons,
course,
right? Because then
you're
not taking it as like, oh, I need this thing to improve my life. It became like, this is a thing that has been through, you know?
You will be able to place the language in its own
context.
You will not learn that language and think in a way that I now need to undress myself, erase myself. Because that's how it was taught to
for
me.
For us. Yeah.
So while learning it because the society around me was so Western-centered, I started feeling that I need to straighten my hair, I need to become less brown, I need to speak with a specific accent, I need to dress a certain way. My mother specifically used to tell us how important it is for a woman, for a girl to not be so brown. So I rebelled against
it. That is insane. And I think for us, what it becomes is, at this stage of our lives, looking back, like what you said, this retracing and looking back at the memories that we've buried, and I realize it's such a loss, you know. I grieve for the girl who thought like, oh yeah, I am getting darker. And it wasn't just darker, right? The implied meaning was you've become uglier. That's what it actually meant.
Of course.
You know, you've become darker because it's
automatically
ugly. Yeah, you're ugly.
Right?
I was 9 when believing that, oh, getting darker is getting uglier.
Because at the age of 8, you are not really engaged with these anti-colonial narratives. There is no way that enters your discourse in the circles that I grew up in. There was no way such discourses entered my circle.
And in the education system as well. So there was no concept of questioning.
No.
Literally, the classroom wasn't a space for questions. It was a space for you sit down and you listen and we will tell you the information you need. Because you are empty vessels. It's a frail concept that I'm borrowing.
Which is why, to this day, I still hate the teaching structures of the classroom where the whole audience
faces that one teacher. Person. Exactly. It's like one, Mahaguru of knowledge is going to like, I will share with you my intelligence. That's not learning. Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, there was this teacher in my school who taught us Sinhalese.
Yeah.
And she was a teacher, I would say she was anti-colonial. She wore, in Sri Lanka we have a different version of sari called the osari.
Okay.
And so she wore an osari to school every day. And she didn't just wear it, she used to try to instill this idea of, again, a sense of nationalism. So she used to kind of not just teach us Sinhalese, but she used to tell us how to honor the people who fought for our freedom.
Exactly, because that's what language is. It's not just the language is the story, is the way we tell the stories of our people, our resistance, our culture.
And then she used to teach us the different aspects of our culture. And then because I was in the bougie circles in the school, they used to laugh at her.
Oh no! And in she order was to, it Gode?
Yeah, she was, wow, you're good. So yeah, she was categorized as Gode because she didn't try to make herself into westernized body.
Yeah.
And so everyone used to laugh at her and kind of say shit about her behind her back. When I started reading into decoloniality, I started thinking about her. I was like, God, I wish I appreciated her, you know? But at that time, in that environment, there was no appreciation for people like that.
Exactly. Which I think is what made what she did, you know, the more significant.
I can imagine how difficult it must have been for
her, she was literally, that was her micro act of resistance, right? That was
She used to even teach us how to respect a teacher. So in Sri Lanka, we have this culture. You know the tree under which Buddha gained Nirvana? So the leaf, it's shaped like a heart, a very long heart. So we used to pile a collection of those leaves and give it to our teacher. And then we would bow down and touch their feet. So whenever, like on Teacher's Day, that we would go to all the teachers, she made sure we did it correctly.
Nice.
Not just bend down and
because
touch the
your
foot,
culture.
Like full on. She made sure we went down. And then at that time, we used to be annoyed, but now I understand.
You realize what she was doing. A few days ago, I went to a memorial reading session for the late Professor Syed Muhammad Naqib Alatas. The beautiful thing that was shared was how he saw the core of the Malay identity is we are orang yang beradab, which is we are a people with culture. We are a people with, you know, like what you said, like that Sinhalese culture, right? We are a people with this revered culture, and one of and berbudi is carry yourself with a certain way of being not just polite and respectful, but you know, like it's very difficult to translate deeply Malay concepts because there is no English word for it, right?
Again, like when did being polite and respectful become something degrading?
But he said that, like, so the greatest form of budi, you know, the greatest way you can be of service to your community is through knowledge, by sharing knowledge. The important role of a teacher in the community is so prevalent in so many indigenous cultures, and we don't realize it until we step out of that space.
You're listening to Accent of Women, produced in the studios of 3CR in Fitzroy, Victoria, and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. We've been listening to a conversation I had with Dr. Sarah Wijesinghe last month. Sarah is a Sri Lankan academic based in Malaysia, whose critical research on post-colonial dynamics and cultural biases explores how deeply ingrained inequalities impact both societal and institutional settings. Sarah's work emphasizes the importance of uncovering implicit biases and rethinking cultural frameworks that sustain inequality. This week, we listened to the second half of our conversation as we spoke about the joys and struggles of recognizing the impact of colonialism on our post-colonial bodies and how decolonization, while necessary, is also a very destabilizing journey that benefits from the supports of others who are doing the same work. It reminded me of something Lebanese activist Majid Issa said at the Palestine Prisoners Day rally in Melbourne last Sunday, when he reminded us of how important it is to first and foremost know who we are in order to stay in this fight for liberation, in the struggle for justice. While much of my conversation with Sarah is grounded in the personal, we are also cognizant of how the personal is impacted by systemic oppression, seeing clearly how colonialism, capitalism, patriarchy work hand in hand to keep us limited in our imaginations.
It's so hard to find these spaces where women like us, you know, not just in academia, but just women like us who have gone through this kind of histories and are now unlearning those histories and relearning and tracing our roots and, you know, discovering memories and like what you said, like the talking about it is an unraveling, right? And I think that unraveling together is beautiful because then we get to weave something different and beautiful together, which I think is...
Yeah, definitely. And I've come to understand why that is. I would say, see, you grow up with these definitions,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then you have these points of aspirations that yeah. you want to succeed in. And then you went to academia.
Yeah.
And then academia doesn't tell you to trace your
yeah.
past. It doesn't
True.
It doesn't tell you to
tells
trace
you to look
your
forward.
No,
yeah.
it tells you here's
Keep
another layer
up.
Of
yeah,
things that you
yeah.
now need
yeah.
to achieve.
Here's new aspirations for you to never achieve. Yeah. yeah.
It doesn't tell you, hey, stop, reflect.
Yes, exactly.
Reflect about how your memories,
Look back. Yeah.
your experiences
yeah.
shape
yeah.
your presence in academia.
Yeah.
I think academia could be a beautiful place if it's just one step out of thousands.
Yes.
if,
yes.
if we were to collectively trace our own stories,
mm.
share our own stories,
yeah.
and
yeah.
not just share them, but reflect on all of the layers of privilege and non-privilege
yeah.
within which we exist in that structure.
Yeah.
But the speed of academia...
Exactly. It doesn't allow for that. It doesn't allow
and
for
I
the pauses.
I think it's systemic.
100%.
Because facing
yeah. if you
these
cannot
stories
stop and
does
think,
not work
that's not
for
benefit.
The system.
Exactly. It will not serve them. Exactly. No, it will disrupt, right? It will disrupt. It will actually decolonize. One of the indigenous concepts we work with is this idea of decolonizing just time. Idea of time itself is a very colonial, exactly. Whereas so much of, again, going back to that idea earlier of asking for forgiveness in Malay, it tends to be a slower, more, you know, layered kind of approach. The idea of indigenous time is more, it's cyclical, it's not linear, right? There's so many concepts of time that is non-linear, but yet we've only just ever subscribed to this Western linear time. And it's not just linear, right? It's always upwards trajectory as well. There is no looking back. There is no, hang on, let's pause here and circle back. Let's go back to another moment. Go backwards a few years, come back, learn something new, go back a few more years and realize, oh hey, this is actually rooted in this other thing. That cyclical nature, those pauses, which is what actually allows room for new ideas and new thought and unlearning to happen. Where
because
is the time
linearity,
to do that?
If you observe, that linearity kind of consumes Western imagination,
yeah,
everything.
Time, capitalism,
human history,
yeah, exactly, which
everything.
Is how, yeah, exactly. Capitalism and neoliberalism keeps trucking on because we don't have the time to stop and question, hang on, why are we functioning like this?
For my PhD research,
yeah.
I went into Malaysia, Thailand and Vietnam.
Ah, beautiful, yeah.
Because of the three different colonial histories.
Yes, experiences.
Thailand never,
yeah, yeah, true.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thailand never
had never
been
had
colonized
a, yeah.
by a European power. But what I came
yeah.
to understand is that because now the educational structures
yeah.
exist under the neoliberal order.
Yeah, everyone.
So, yeah, so even Thailand that has never been colonized by a European power, their education system still benchmark against
because,
American Western education.
Because
logic.
they define the definitions, right? Those are the people who get to define the definitions, and which is why it's something we can never achieve in a sense, because
yeah.
we are not the one making the definitions, and it keeps changing according to them.
Yeah.
It's a system built by them for them. Right? So
what
just,
scares me the most
yeah.
is how I'm unable to step out of that imagination.
Dislodge, exactly. Because we were not taught what were the alternative. Not that it didn't exist. There was a world before colonialism.
Yes, of
it's
course.
Just it's been buried.
Not according to them.
Therefore, not according to the curriculum we learned. So
no,
we
no,
never knew
we were
it.
Discovered, right?
In Australia, they say terra nullius. You know,
we don't know how we survived there. Until then.
No, we were just savages living in caves.
Yeah.
Apparently, in Singapore, the trope is we were a sleepy fishing village before the British came. You know, we were fishermen, but not all of us. We're not
no,
a monolith,
no.
you know, by my goodness.
We didn't know what else to do. We learn to speak and write and do all those things. I don't know how.
I don't know how. Yeah.
Out of sheer luck.
I don't know how we actually had another language somehow, and then the British came, and then And that's the thing, right? And so that curbs our imagination. How do you imagine something? And not to say that we need a blueprint for imagination, but what we said, because of the way the world is built now, the way the pace of the world right now, even the time and room and energy for imagination we don't have. Just having an understanding that a whole world, a very full, complete, rich, diverse world existed pre-colonization is not knowledge we have access to easily. So then it becomes even more difficult to kind of think like, oh, what would be a world without colonization look like? But actually, that's where the unlearning and relearning new things, indigenous cultures, African cultures, where actually in many pockets it actually continues, just that we don't know about it because it hasn't been formalized. We don't know it, so then we lose, just like losing our language, we lose that space of our brain where we could have possibly imagined the world in Sinhalese or in Malay. We lose that ability to imagine a world beyond colonialism because we never got to see, like read or learn about that world.
So I was once teaching this PhD class on the philosophy of social science. So out of curiosity, I asked my students, what is knowledge? And they gave me a few answers, like knowledge is what you find on Google, what is published in top journals. Knowledge is what is written. And after hearing those answers, I just drew this big circle on the board, and I put a little tiny dot on that circle. And I said, this is your imagination of the world of knowledge, that tiny dot. And we tend to describe the whole world on the basis of that tiny dot.
That's beautiful.
When we don't even know what the rest of the circle
encapsulates,
right? But we are so arrogant about what we think we know.
Our hubris. I would say that was kind of what I did appreciate, how COVID really shattered that hubris. We really thought we as a man have come so far, we are so, you know, technologically advanced, and then a pandemic arrived and we were a mess. We did not know how to handle that, and it was so humbling. And I thought that was such an important moment to go, hang on, you are not all that great.
Again, that ideology, also the notion of human imagination,
the superiority of man,
the anthropocentrism, human at the center,
human center.
On that point of imagination, I think is the Sousa Santo for epistemicide. So part of the colonial project was to destroy your history. So when I read that they burned more like hundreds of thousands of books in Al-Andalus, and I was like, that is knowledge you can never have
recover.
Access
exactly.
to. Never.
Exactly. It's always the universities, the libraries, any genocide, even the ones ongoing today. The schools, it's the libraries, it's the universities that gets destroyed because...
So there goes the imagination,
exactly.
Right?
There goes the imagination, and you can call people savages if they have no history, they don't have a record of their civilization.
And honestly, I feel that is part of the reality of our civilizations, that I no longer have access to the deeper histories of my
ancestral
people.
Knowledge,
And as a result, I am this kind of like a floating
untethered
being.
Exactly. We are untethered. All of us are untethered. We are not
we don't
alone.
Know who we are.
We don't know who we are, exactly. We are alone in our own bodies because we are disconnected from our own bodies. Your dislocation began from such a young age. We were all dislocated by colonialism.
I went through that when I started my PhD project into this decoloniality.
Yeah.
There was a point that during that journey that I lost my ground. Right?
That sense of being.
And then I was just this floating entity and I didn't know where to keep my feet. So I was like,
where
who
do you
am
belong?
I?
Exactly.
If I remove these aspects that were ideological.
Exactly.
How do I define myself otherwise?
Because you've always been defined by others. But that's the thing, right? When we are like ephemera, just floating through this space, that's to their advantage. That's where the system can then be the one to tell you, oh yeah, this is who you are. This is who you want to be. You want to be a doctor. You want to be an expert in your field, speaking at conferences. They get to tell you who you are because you don't know who you are. And it's having that strong core and that strong sense of self is actually what allows us to do this acts of refusal, this imagining otherwise, this resistance, however micro acts of resistance, but those are the things that every time you choose to do that, you recenter yourself and you go, oh, hang on, I can push back against this, I can question this. Yeah, and every time you meet someone else who does that, I think there is also power in that sharing that journey together.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because sometimes you can't ask yourself what you don't know.
And also, maybe there's also humility in accepting that there will always be unknowns, but then being able to then acknowledge that is also important, as opposed to just pretending the unknown doesn't exist.
You are listening to Accent of Women, and you have just heard the second half of my conversation with Dr. Sarah, a senior lecturer at Sunway University, Malaysia, sharing about her own struggles towards decolonizing herself and hence her students and the research work she does. While we never really arrived at any grand conclusions, I hope the explorations of possibilities, the journey of tracing how systems affect us, has been a balm for your soul as it has been for mine. In a lovely corner of Coburg here in Melbourne is a former Lebanese grocery store where three sisters, Safa, Emina and Fatima El Samad, now run Dukana, a free community space that is accessible to people of the global majority. On one wall hangs a hand-painted banner with the words of Chelsea Kwakye. As a minority in a predominantly white space, to take up space is itself an act of resistance. I hope our fellow listeners keep resisting and keep finding people to take up space with. Accent of Women is produced in the Melbourne studios of Community Radio 3CR with the financial assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The show is distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network, with special thanks to the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Music for Accent of Women was written and produced by George Kunjeri. If you want to hear this show again or any of our previous programs, you can download the podcast from 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au, and go to the Accent of Women page and follow the links to this week's show. If you want to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can write to us at accentofwomen@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in to the program. I'm Fiza, and we look forward to your company again next week. Levi Nerie numbena ke magenet ne hame hayavi si bevi ma talaga madavatena urupemaka patalena uvanari manhari sukumali numbatama talaga madavatena urupemaka patalena uvanari manhari
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.